This is Icon Art Radio, and I'm here with my co-host Alan Cobb and our special guest Paul Glossop, who we have been trying to figure out how to describe who he is and what he does. He's an amateur geometer. He's a student of geometry. I guess those are both
Related.
We could call him a builder, but we would have to call him a sacred builder. He's a creative force in Fairfield that I think a lot of people don't know about because his activities are kind of quiet, but they're exceptional and they have a very profound influence on our environment and on our lives in their subtle ways. So welcome, Paul.
Thank you.
Would you like to make any kind of opening statement? Because what I've said is fairly obscure and cryptic.
Well, I think the definition of amateur is somebody who loves something, and it's better to love something than to be a professional at it, perhaps. I love ancient geometry, and ancient geometry has a whole different flavor from the scientific geometry that you may have been introduced to in school, or you probably were, which is a little bit on the dry side, let's say. So I went through that, and I did enjoy it when I was in school. But at this period of my life, I've become interested in how ancient buildings were made, how they were designed, the underlying principles, and how the same milieu, the same construction principles could be used again for more modern buildings. And looking into that, I've gone into the philosophical area to build up the science, as it were, from the deepest level that I could find and move outwards from there. So I make a distinction between what's popularly called sacred geometry and scientific geometry. What you learned in school was the scientific geometry. Now, sacred geometry adds a dimension, and that dimension is human consciousness. Science tries to keep human consciousness out of the equation for the repeatability of the experiments. So you reduce the scientist to a point, as it were, and to a nothing, to an abstraction, and then you do the experiment 100 times, and if it comes out exactly the same, you've more or less proved your point in science. However, that leaves the observer, it leaves the experimenter somewhat out of the equation. And since we're doing science, ultimately, for human fulfillment, we need to embrace the observer. Now, in this milieu of Fairfield, where we have the legacy of the knowledge of Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, which is hugely valuable in a philosophical sense, we know that the commonality in the observer is the field of consciousness. So what we add to the experience of observation, which contains three elements, those three elements being observer, means of observation, and observed, which everybody goes through when they're doing experiments or anything else, we add a whole dimension to the field of the observer. And I believe that sacred geometry is sacred because it adds the consciousness of the observer and keeps the other aspects of geometry lively. In fact, re-enlivens them from what you might have learned before about congruent triangles and similar circles and whatever. When we add this element of consciousness, we also juxtapose it with geometry, which is a science that almost proves itself. We have a very, very interesting combination. So at one end in sacred geometry, there's consciousness. At the other end, there's the gross manifestation in the form of buildings, which spring from geometry. And in between is some very interesting geometry and some very interesting principles.
Well, that was a great bridge between the totally abstract and the totally concrete. I mean, what could be more concrete than a building? And what could be more abstract than geometry without getting right out of the realm of thought?
Well, I'd like the listeners to visualize four things, two of which are probably familiar to everybody. The first thing is the Big Bang. And without going into any of the details, the Big Bang supposedly is this huge explosion that started off the universe and spread everywhere throughout space and originated in an infinitesimal point of great energy. Well, incalculable energy. The second thing I'd like them to visualize is the black hole, which everybody also has heard of, which is where the material of the universe is pulled into what's called a singularity, which is also a tiny point. At least the center of the black hole is this tiny point of almost infinite mass and completely unknown physical properties. Now, interestingly, those first two, they both deal with something that's called a point of departure and a point of collapse. But the two haven't, as far as I know, have not been identified with each other yet. But not to go any further into that, just to make the point about two points. I mentioned Maharishi Mahesh Yogi earlier. Now, in his talks about creation from the point of view of consciousness, he says that consciousness originates from infinity collapsing to a point. So that's a pretty heavy statement. So here we have a third reference to a point. And then going a little bit further to something which many Western people might not be familiar with, but in the Hindu/Vedic tradition, there's a very well-known devotional picture. And the picture looks something like this. At the bottom of the picture is the ocean of consciousness, the ocean of potentiality. And reclining on that ocean is a very serious force of nature called Vishnu. And massaging Vishnu's feet is Mother Divine, who is another great force in creation. Now, coming out of Vishnu's navel is a stalk, a long stalk, that goes upwards. And the stalk ends in a lotus flower. And sitting in the lotus flower is another very well-known, at least in the Eastern world, force of nature called Brahma. And Brahma has four heads. Now, this ostensibly is a devotional picture. The deities in question are clad beautifully. They're mightily powerful. They're very warm among each other, and they're in a very interesting setting. However, if you strip away the raiment, and if you strip away the personality, what you're left with is a very old mathematical conundrum. And so we'll look at the picture in another way and say that the causative ocean, which is lying at the bottom of the picture, is an infinite circle or an infinite sphere. But Vishnu's belly is a middling circle, and Vishnu's navel, where the stalk comes from, is a point. And that picture represents what Maharishi spoke of when he said infinity collapses to a point. In this case, it's personified. Now, what comes out of the point, what grows out of the navel, is a stalk, which is a stream of potentiality. And then at the end of the stalk is this lotus flower, which is the expression of the potentiality. And then sitting or born out of the lotus flower is the force of nature called Brahma. And Brahma is identified as the architect of creation. And interestingly, Brahma has these four heads, one pointing north, one pointing south, one pointing east, one pointing west. And so what you have essentially, from a mathematical point of view, is a squaring of the circle. Vishnu represents the circle, roughly speaking, and Brahma represents the square. Most architectural developments come in the form of a square. I know there are circular buildings, but the most common thing in architecture is the square. Now, it so happens that there's a pursuit in mathematics that goes back for thousands of years called squaring the circle. And this pursuit in the recent few thousand years has been considered very mathematical. I suggest that this squaring of the circle comes from this ancient philosophical consideration, and that it is actually the essence of sacred geometry. And so I've worked in practical terms with the circle and the square, and sort of marrying the circle and the square to see what happens, geometrically speaking, and in terms of very simple diagrams, when these two are brought together. And it has, in fact, brought out a great number of interesting constructions, which then form the tools that can be used in making buildings, perhaps, or making jewelry, or making mandalas, which are these symmetrical visual impressions. So that's some of the philosophy that supports this practical expression of geometry that I've been concerned about.
Well, let me just point out to the listening audience, in case you just jumped into your car and turned this on, that it's not Science Hour. It is the integration of science and art with our guest, Paul Glossop. Go ahead, Alan.
Well, I think you probably have a comment. What you did. I was going to.
Well, we're really lucky to have Paul here today, and we're mining him for all the information, and we want to know more about what he's doing in town. So go ahead, Alan.
Well, I was admiring your presentation, which was astonishingly compact given the scope of the content. And while I was doing that, I was also looking at this mandala-like arrangement of precious stones and coral and metal that you placed on the table in front of us all. And although this is radio, I'd love to know more about what that is and how it connects to what we were just talking about.
Well, having established some form of the basis of sacred geometry, sacred geometry moves into various areas of physicality. Mathematical geometry is one thing, but sacred geometry deals with thick lines, real lines, lines that are in the world. Mm-hmm. And so there are various fields that it can be used for in terms of design. Buildings is one, and jewelry is another. I happen to be in a costume jewelry store, a used costume jewelry store, the other day, and I saw all these beautiful circles. They were semi-precious stones set in symmetrically circular settings of different metals, different stones, different colors, all very attractive. But to me, they showed up some of the basic principles of how artistic works come from sacred geometry. And here's one that has a gem at each corner in the form of a square, and then another smaller gem in the middle of each side of the square. And it's a very beautiful piece that would decorate a lady. Probably it's 50 years old. The one next to it, so that's the square. The next one around is based on the pentagon. So it has five jewels set in it with another five around the outside. And as we go around, we come to one which I think I had one which is six somewhere. There's certainly one which is has three. So this one divides the circle into three. It's very beautiful dark gems on a dark setting. And then there's another one with highly colored gems on a gold background, which divides the circle into eight. Now, the tools of sacred geometry, let's step back one step. You need basic tools in order to create designs. And you have two elements in typical geometry. You have the straight line and you have the curve. All curves can be thought of as part of circles, and all straight lines go on forever in both directions. But if you take a section of a straight line and you want to divide it into six or seven or eight or nine or ten pieces, there is a geometrical tool to do that. There are also different geometrical tools that allow you to divide the circle into 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. Some of them are easy and some of them are quite surprising. So what you have in that division, so the circle is more difficult to divide than the straight line, but it can be done. What you have when you do the geometrical division of a circle is you have a path from the point, from the original point at the center of the circle, through a few strokes of what's called construction, which is drawing lines with compasses and straight edges, to dividing the circle into the desired number of pieces. And that, in a way, is a spiritual path from the zero point to this point of an absolute number, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. And if you know that path, then you have a way to consider the geometry as being 8 or 7 or 6 around a circle, and also a way of getting back to the initial point where that was divided from. And so one application of sacred geometry is in jewelry. The same thing can be done in buildings. And we have a whole area in Fairfield where we produce buildings that are essentially based on geometrical principles.
Now, when you mentioned tools earlier, you're talking about procedural techniques for using the straight edge and compass to achieve specific results, to divide a circle in a certain way. The tool is actually a procedure.
Yes, the tool is a procedure. The actual physical tools of geometry are an unmarked straight edge, mm-hmm, and a pair of compasses, which is, as you know, a point on one end and a pencil on the other, which you can draw a circle with. Those are the two physical tools. And there's a very small handful of rules about the way you use those tools called the Euclidean rules. And they're used to develop from the point, generally. And this is all geometry really essentially starts from the point. But you could also say that if you blow on the point enough, 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 it blows up into a circle.
Yes. Well, when I did my Ashtanga Kosh installation at Gallery 51 umpteen years ago, there was a stony-looking sphere in the center of the room, which you can see in the center, in the corner of this room, which I described as a dimensionless point which had been enlarged for your convenience.
Oh, well, that's a...
That was in three space, but it was still the idea that it was a dimensionless point, And because we can't see dimensionless points, it had to be enlarged, or the visitors to the gallery wouldn't have been able to enjoy it.
It is the first stage, and I think yeah. it's like blowing up a balloon. You somehow, the point lies at the center of the circle. It's the circle is equidistant from the point, but a circle is a blown-up point.
Yeah. I wonder if you could even say that the point is where thought begins, where any kind of conceptualization really has to begin. It begins outside of specificity, and yet it has to be as specific as it... if it's not specific, then there is no thought at all. But if it has location without dimension, that's essentially what a point is, in a sense. And then everything begins from there.
Yeah,
the Big Bang, in a sense, may even be, although it's physical, it may also be a metaphor for how it all works, how anything works.
It could be, and it could be that when I brought with me a number of books to sort of inspire me.
We're going to read them all now.
There's about 20.
Yes, now we're going to read them out loud.
We have about 26 weeks. So. Right. Now let me get back to this thing. Yeah. I'm seeing the point and the circle as wholeness, as a unity. It's unified. The point is unified. There's no real starting to relative structures happening yet.
There's no duality.
And the circle is a reflection of that. It's still a silent whole. And then the dynamics, where you blow it up to the circle, the dynamics of stuff happening, you might say, between the point and the edge, which could be an infinite edge, but we're talking about a circle. That is this dynamics of 2, 4, 6, 7, 11, starting to become structured in that?
Well, I'm sure at this level there are many different ways to think of it, but my way of thinking in the geometric way is that something it starts with a point. First of all, you should understand that there are two ways of seeing geometry. If you're an observer and you open a book, you see a geometrical diagram, and it's all done for you, and there's no flow. If you're doing the geometry yourself, and you're doing what's called a construction, you typically start from a point or a circle, and you're very much involved in the development from the circle to wherever your goal is. And that involvement gives you a completely different view, a participatory view, and everybody should do it.
Go ahead.
My thought is that, going back to the example I gave of those major forces of nature, that the first thing is the point. The next thing, the next geometrical object is the circle. And then human consciousness looks at that circle and says, I must put a square around it. And then human consciousness says, well, I must put a square inside it too.
Right.
Now then a slightly different, well, now let me just get to those two squares to describe what we're talking about. A square around a circle, the four sides of the square touch the circumference of the circle. So they're joined. The square inside the circle, usually drawn on the same horizontal, the four corners of the square touch the inside of the circle. Now, that's one style of thinking that's very visual, but there's this more subtle style of thinking that introduces two more squares, and those squares are the square whose area equals the area of the circle, and the square whose perimeter equals the length of the circumference of the circle. Those two squares happen to sit in between the first two mentioned squares. Now, if you take that as a starting point for sacred geometry, you have two squares that are produced very obviously by the eye, two squares that are produced, the latter two squares, produced by something more subtle that happens in the mind when you realize, well, that square outside is sort of equal to the circle, that square inside is sort of equal to the circle, and yet those other two squares are equal to the circle in two other ways. You have the founding circle, and you have a family of four important squares. And I suggest that this is where sacred geometry really starts, is with this important family of squares. And to perhaps to move towards the finish of this section, everybody knows mathematics, but few people know that probably more hours of human time in the mathematical field have been spent on the subject of what's called squaring the circle than on any other mathematical problem ever. Now, it's not very popular these days because pure mathematicians have come along and sort of said, it's impossible to do. By their definition, it is impossible. But by the definitions of sacred geometry, it is completely possible and it's welcome, and it starts in the direction of a wonderful new science or a forgotten science. And as somebody who's enthusiastic about this subject, I feel like I'm putting together the shards of an old pot.
Well, it sounds like a reminiscent of alchemy, where, you know, where there's a total picture of the reality being explained as opposed to just some scientific material sort of like element to it.
Yeah, this is not a picture. This is it.
It's the pursuit of squaring the circle sounds like, you know, finding the that elixir that we find in the center of the fulcrum.
And I love the way the four squares seem to represent two from the left hemisphere, the right hemisphere, and then the left hemisphere, realizing there are two more equivalent squares. I hope we can continue this in our next show.
You've been listening to Icon Art Radio, a production of Iowa Contemporary Art, Fairfield.